Conservative. Constitutional. It's the Andrew Cooper Writer Show, keeping you informed on what's going on right here in Kentucky.
Today on the Andrew Cooper Writer Show, yesterday took a break from doing a good, the bad, the ugly that happened during this last legislative session because, well, there was just a few stories I really needed to cover, but we are back at it today doing a good, the bad, the ugly, covering some good things that passed. But of course, there's almost always something kind of negative lining there because it illustrates just how hard it was and currently still is, unless some things change, to get this Republican legislature, specifically Republican leadership, to do some really strong conservative things. The bad things are things that really shouldn't have passed if the legislature was a strong conservative one. And the ugly one today will zero in on certificate of need law and what exactly happened on that. And one very, very ugly hearing this session. Something that was done, obviously, for political spite, to flex political muscle, and for the establishment to remind the hospital associations' monopolies why they need to keep giving them so much money. So we'll be digging into that hearing. We'll have all that and more today on the Andrew Cooper Writer Show. I hope everybody's having a fantastic Thursday today, and I hope you're excited. Now, as always, head on over to theandrewshow.com. Once again, that's theandrewshow.com. You can reach out to the show there, hit the contact tab, reach on out, leave a message, or you can also email info@theandrewshow.com. I appreciate your emails. I address things on the air when they need to be addressed. And also the tips and the stories do help as well. Gives us some things to cover right here on the show. But before we dig into the good, the bad, the ugly, I want to start off with just a little bit of news on diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI. Bill, of course, those of you who don't know, DEI sounds great, diversity, equity, inclusion, but generally it deals with things like racial quotas. In this case, we're going to be talking about racial quotas that stem from DEI practices because, well, if something is not racially perfectly aligned or even if quote-unquote underrepresented minorities are not overrepresented in an organization, well, then it must be no good, dirty, racist, horrible organization, and DEI initiatives aim to fix that. But obviously, when you start talking about race and hiring quotas, that is racial, that is partially unconstitutional. And you may remember Senate Bill 6 from this legislative year. That was a DEI bill aimed at removing the wasteful DEI practices in our public colleges and universities. Not just something that's unconstitutional, but something that we spend a lot of money for nothing. It really doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter to anybody what anybody's skin color is. It shouldn't matter what skin color your doctor is, what gender your doctor is. It shouldn't matter as much what you know, gender or skin color a mathematician is, a scientist is. It really shouldn't matter. All that should matter is that we're getting the best people we can for the job. Now, sometimes I could understand if you're a male wanting a male doctor or a female wanting a female doctor as your general practitioner. As you talk about your body, it sometimes might be hard to describe things to somebody who doesn't have the same parts. But anyways, point is that it shouldn't matter, though, as far as getting the job done. We just want the best person we can get. But DEI says we should value something other than just finding the best person. We should value immutable characteristics, like a person's skin color, something that is quite ridiculous. And so not only, right, unconstitutional, but we spend tens of millions of dollars a year on DEI departments in our publics, colleges, and universities, and that's something every taxpayer should be concerned with because we give the universities hundreds of millions of dollars a year out of our general funds, as well as monies from keys, from the lottery side of things in the form of scholarships, and of course as well, federal tax dollars through federal grants or through FAFSA. And so there is a practical side and a reason why taxpayers should be concerned about these public universities wasting millions of dollars a year, even outside of maybe the ideological reasons, just the sheer fiscal reasons. Well, the Office of Attorney General, and this kind of goes into Senate Bill 6 earlier in this year, issued an opinion on the current DEI practices and laws regulating our Kentucky universities that are promulgated by the CPE, the Council on Post-Secondary Education here in Kentucky. And in it, the AG lays out the problem with what's currently going on. I'm going to read to you now from that. I'm just going to read kind of from the first page here that is laying out what the issue is here. So funding and programming dependent on adhering to race-based policy. So as a reminder, this is from the Office of the Attorney General. Under the current statutory and regulatory system in Kentucky, funding for public post-secondary institutions and approval for programming is dependent on the institutions demonstrating progress towards exclusively race-based policies. The General Assembly has established a funding scheme for Kentucky public universities and the Kentucky Community and Technical College System, KRS 164.092. Under that scheme, 35% of total resources shall be distributed based on whether the institution can demonstrate success outcomes according to factors laid out in the statute. One of these factors is how many bachelor degrees or credentials are earned by underrepresented minority students. Additionally, the approval of any new program at a public post-secondary institution will be postponed unless the institution has met its equal educational opportunity goal. The Council on Post-Secondary Education, CPE, is tasked with establishing policies to make recommendations for post-secondary institutions' appropriations. And with establishing the equal educational opportunity goals that public post-secondary institution must meet, CPE promulgated a Kentucky regulation to establish the equal opportunity goals. The regulation requires all state-supported post-secondary education institutions to develop a diversity plan that must be submitted to the CPE for approval. The 2016 Kentucky Post-Secondary Education Policy for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion is incorporated by reference into the regulation and serves as the current policy. As such, the 2016 policy shall provide the framework and guidelines for developing the post-secondary institutions' diversity plans. The 2016 policy defines underrepresented minority as students who categorize themselves as Hispanic or Latino, American Indian or Alaska Native, Black or African American, Native Hawaiian or other specific islander, or two or more races. CPE uses this exclusively race-based definition to determine the progress of state-supported post-secondary institutions. CPE's 2023 review of the progress made by Kentucky public post-secondary institutions explained that campuses negotiated targets with CPE staff for the percentage of first-year students who are Black or African-American and Hispanic. And they also may establish targets for students who are classified as two or more races. Now, that's just a part of the Attorney General's statement, but what he is saying here is that our colleges and universities, because of government regulations coming from the Council on Post-Secondary Education, are having their funding determined on whether or not they have enough minorities, whether or not they have enough Black people at their school in their first year, whether or not they have enough Pacific Islanders or not, or Native Americans or not. Basically, they only get funding as long as they don't have too many white people. A big chunk of their funding is determined by that, and that's promulgated by our government. And the Attorney General's, you know, opinion here is that based upon the rulings out of the state Supreme Court and based upon the Constitution of the United States, the CPE's policy of defining underrepresented minority as by your skin color only is unconstitutional and needs to be changed. So not only was Senate Bill 6 needed from Ashir, we shouldn't be spending money on this, it's wasteful, it's wrong, but also that more of our money, if because Senate Bill 6 didn't pass, more of our money may be spent trying to sue these universities to comply with the Constitution in the first place. So the legislature did make one action on DEI in response to this constitutional concern. We'll be going over that after this short break. You listen to the Andrew Cooperrider Show, your source for Kentucky politics. And you're back with the Andrew Cooper Writer Show, your source for Kentucky politics. Before the break, we were talking about the failure of Senate Bill 6, but more importantly about the Attorney General had issued an opinion clearly demonstrating that the Council on Post-Secondary Education here in Kentucky was promulgating unconstitutional regulations by tying university funding to whether or not they brought in enough black people and other minorities, underrepresented, quote-unquote, minorities into their colleges and universities for first year. And if they didn't hit goals that were negotiated with the Council on Post-Secondary Education, a state government entity, by the way, well, then they would have their funding jeopardized. They would have a big chunk of their funding jeopardized and their ability to expand to new programs halted as well. And so the Office of the Attorney General said, whoa, 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 you have to do something about this. But what's interesting, though, about this whole push on underrepresented minorities, what about underrepresented groups in general? The supposed argument here is that these individuals, these groups, these colleges, can counsel on post-secondary education, just care so much that everybody is equally represented. But there actually is a large group of people, actually 50% of our population, that is underrepresented by large numbers at our colleges and universities. And that, of course, is men. Almost specifically, too, as well, if you want to get into it, white men. But let's just stay with the gender, men. For an example, at the University of Kentucky, women outnumber men by a vast majority, with over 60% of college students enrolled at UK being female. Now, is there a policy to try and recruit more men into the colleges? Is there some sort of special Title IX push going the other direction to say that clearly colleges and universities are creating environments that are, attacking men, that are somehow hostile towards men? Is there any discussion of that at all? Of course not. And if they start talking about that, that would be an absurd thing. They would never talk about that because men in this culture that our colleges and universities are programming their graduates with, men are not a victim class. And that is just part of the programming. But also, too, there isn't as much profit on it because if you will remember, the director of CPE, the president of the college the Council on Post-Secondary Education here in Kentucky is Aaron Thompson. Aaron Thompson, he is black, but more importantly, he's wrote several of these textbooks. I covered this on the show, so go back and listen to old shows, theandrewshow.com. But he's wrote several textbooks on this thing, on DEI. Textbooks that are required at universities and a part of some classes. He makes a profit from DEI. And you may wonder, why did Senate Bill 6 fail then? Because Aaron Thompson didn't like the changes to the bill. It came out of the Senate, passed the Senate fine. But then over in the House, the DEI offices were completely defunded. The colleges and universities were told they could no longer, and CPE could no longer promulgate regulations based upon people's skin color. Basically, the universities had to be truly colorblind, and they could not mandate any kind of teachings that tell people that there's a victim class group, that America's uniquely rated, that anything that is debatable, divisive concepts like that, debatable things need to be presented as debatable and cannot be required. And this would cut into Aaron Thompson's bottom line because he wouldn't be able to sell as many textbooks. And Aaron Thompson is from Clay County. He grew up with Senate President Stivers, also from Clay County. That's right, the good old boys system of Kentucky is alive and well. And it exists for the very same reason, in order to line the pockets of individuals. But the problem with this new type of corruption we have going on with our good old boy system is it's not just promulgating government regulations that line a particular person's pocket, like the corruption of yesteryear. In this case, an especially dangerous thing here, because they're doing this and allowing this to go forward, the next generation of voters are being inculcated with a thought process that goes against the very values Republicans are supposed to claim to have. And while I don't actually believe for one second that Republican leadership in the state can even for a minute actually cohesively explain what is a conservative value, what makes them a Republican versus a Democrat. I mean, they may try. They could try to claim fiscal things. But we all know with a budget 57% higher, adjusted for inflation, than the Democrat budgets, Republicans spending 57% more, it'd be hard to claim that. It'd be hard to claim that when Beshear was calling for universal pre-K, and then we had Republicans come in and one-up him, like Senator Danny Carroll, that called for massive child care spending, claiming that with his Horizons Act, it's important that we get to children at birth and start running government education starting at birth, passing bills even that have computer programs starting for kids at a young age that include government-funded internet and computer packages. So the claim of fiscal conservative doesn't make much sense. So, of course, the only real difference here is that Democrats would pass laws that actively push their liberal social agenda, while Republican leadership doesn't do that. Now, it's very hard to get them to pass something that will fight the liberal social agenda, as we saw with the failure of Senate Bill 6 and Senate Bill 147 that fights on drag shows. But they won't pass laws actively pushing it. So Senate Bill 6 dies, but that doesn't change the fact that the Attorney General has issued an opinion, and that opinion exists. And that Coleman, if he's a man of his word, and we're going to first get to see it on this, that he may be forced to act or look feckless unless something changes in the CPE, Council on Post-Secondary Education, funding model. So in response, the legislature, in its last 2 days, amended Senate Bill 191. Now, Senate Bill 191 was a college funding bill used to address non-traditional age students, basically to provide special funding for older students going to college here in Kentucky. And it was amended to be, something was added to it to say that no college funding model can use race-based metrics here in Kentucky. However, it was passed after the veto period. So Beshear can veto this bill. Now, what's interesting, though, is this bill received no votes in the Senate initially. And then, as reported by Austin Horn, the Democrats in the Senate became aware that the bill had changed and included no race-based funding models, and they went back and amended their votes to a no votes. So there is a pretty good chance that Beshear may veto this bill. And the question will become, does the Attorney General act on our behalf? Does he follow up on his opinion that CPE's current regulations on race-based funding models is unconstitutional and sue the CPE to come in line with the United States Constitution, or does he wimp out? That will be the question. Or does Beshear allow Senate Bill 191 to pass because he doesn't want the showdown? That would be a good question. As promised, though, I said we talked about the good, the bad, and the ugly. So let's dig in to some of the good that happened from this session. Of course, we have House Bill 357. That was a transaction code law for guns. Some of you may remember this, that it banned credit card companies from coding transactions that occur at gun stores as anything other than sporting goods stores. So priorly, if you went and purchased a gun from, Dick's doesn't really sell guns anymore, but if you went and purchased something from a sporting goods store like Dick's or a gun store, credit card companies would code it the same way in their systems. But they created a new code specifically for gun stores. And the concern here was this was creating a list of gun owners that could be accessible to the government. In fact, anti-gun activists were the ones who went to credit card companies and asked them to create this transaction code in the first place. So with the passage of House Bill 357, that would ban credit card companies from being able to have that specialized transaction code for gun stores in Kentucky. Another good thing, and I just want to mention it because I covered this Monday, obviously, was verification for pornography websites before they deliver content. I want to mention that as I move forward and talk about an overall thing about the good. House Bill 8 passed with a sales tax exemption on gold. So with that, Kentucky became the 45th state to not charge sales tax on precious metals, gold, silver, other precious metals. House Bill 18, that was a good bill that passed. That stopped cities from mandating that landlords must accept Section 8 housing vouchers that they can't say, look, we don't take Section 8 housing vouchers. Of course, that was a property rights concern. I dug into this a lot on the show. So if I'm talking about bills and you're like, I want to learn more about that bill, head on to theandrewshow.com, go back, look at old episodes, because I talk a lot about all these different bills throughout the session, and I don't want to spend a bunch of time rehashing them. I just want to mention some of the good things to mention there. Now, what's interesting about those four bills that I mentioned, right? And basically that is, you know, you put a gun to my head and said, best things that happen out of the session, I'd start listing those things. Out of all four of those things that I just listed, only one of them, Beshear vetoed. Well, I get maybe one and a half-ish, because there's like a weird thing happened with House Bill 8 on the veto, but put that to the side. Only one of those things, House Bill 18, did Beshear actually veto. Two of those things became law without his signature, and one of those things he signed. He didn't have an issue with. So, gun to my head, best conservative things that we did this session. Somebody demanding I say it, and I just go to spit it out. The four I can come up with, top of my head, in that stressful situation. Out of those four, Beshear only took issue, only vetoed one of them. He took issue technically with two, but he only vetoed one of them. The top issues. Which tells you just how feckless this is. The best, most conservative Republican things I can think of that we did were so barely conservative that Beshear didn't veto three out of four of them. It really points to the future here. Well, coming up after this, we'll go over the bad and the ugly. You're listening to The Andrew Cooperrider Show, your source for Kentucky politics. And you're back with The Andrew Cooperrider Show, your source for Kentucky politics. Before the break, I was going over the good. I said I'd go over the bad and ugly, but I do have one more good thing I do want to mention, and I want to let you know about. House Bill 2, of course, passed. That was good. That will put a school choice amendment on the ballot this November, giving a chance for Kentuckians to vote on whether or not they want school choice in Kentucky. But there is a little bit of a bad thing here, which is why it's kind of an in-between issue, is that, you know, the wording on the amendment may not be great. The way it was kind of handled may not be great, and there's some questions regarding it, and hopefully the Supreme Court allows it to stand. But recently, Senate President Stiver said that, you know, they think House Bill 2 has a chance to pass, but, you know, nothing's for sure. There's nothing's guaranteed. But he says once and for all, we'll be able to answer the question. This will end the conversation one way or another. So Stiver has indicated that if House Bill 2 doesn't pass, they're not going to try a school choice amendment again, which makes you really wish we'd gotten a perfect bill passed on school choice, a perfectly worded amendment that stood the best chance for passing if it's going to be one and done, if the legislature is saying they'll never pass another thing like this again. But that points, too, to why we have to work so hard to get this passed, to get House Bill 2 passed, because if it fails, that may be the last chance in probably a decade, maybe, that we have of getting school choice accomplished, potentially. It could put a real dent in the process to getting more educational opportunities for our kids, opportunities for kids to be able to not be locked in just because of their parents' financial status, that they are stuck getting this inculcating, awful education that is just failing. And maybe your local schools are great, and I hope they are, but in a lot of these places, like Louisville and others, they are not good schools. They're just not good public schools. They're failing. The school district there is failing. I mean, like I shared with you last week, the school district there just cut off busing to like 10,000 kids, just saying, nope, never mind, we're not going to bus you anymore. Like, that's how bad it's getting. So certainly school choice passing is good, but it does have to handle. Now, here goes some of the bad that happened this session. One of the things bad that continued on in our budget was $2,000 bonuses yearly for teachers to go get a special certification from a DEI group. I covered this when I did my budget episodes, my budget shows, as I was digging through our budget, covering some different things we were spending money on. Those were a few months ago. But one of the things in these budgets, and has been in these budgets for years, is for teachers to get a $2,000 a year bonus for getting a special certification. But this certification from the National Board of Teachers Certifications, I believe is what it's called, they push a lot of these DEI concepts. So at the same time that our you know, legislature was supposedly going to pass a bill on DEI, which ended up failing. At the same time they're doing that, they're giving $2,000 to our teachers to go to incentivize them to go get certified from a group that pushes the very same things that they're supposedly trying to fight. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And by pushing DEI, one of the things that this group that we're paying for teachers to go get certified by pushes is, racial struggle sessions for our encouraging guidance counselors to set up groups to sit and talk about racism and racial struggle sessions to cover how racial inequities may be happening in the schools, so like students to engage in instead of, you know, learning math or reading. That would certainly be important. Another thing that bad, obviously, that happened was the overall spending was just huge. A gigantic spending and a whole lot of wasteful spending. And like I said, I went in depth in a lot of these spending things on the show, but I just some of the highlights, giving millions to Louisville Opera to teach social justice rap classes while the Louisville Opera is in the black and making millions of dollars a year. Special projects on parks that private groups and private companies are the ones trying to get your tax dollars to fund and to push forward. Funding for convention centers while at the same time spending tens of millions of dollars to build a temporary legislative chamber for a few years while the chambers in our traditional capital are remodeled and rehabilitated. Big problems there. Different spending initiatives in House Bill 1, going to Louisville, $100 million going to Louisville for special spending projects, all of them questionable at least, and none of them dealing with what Louisville's real issues are, which is nobody wants to invest money in a town where you have to worry about getting shot if you walk down the wrong street, which is part of the big issue that Louisville's facing and probably a bigger problem. Now, another thing, we're kind of going into ugly because this problem here, it's bad, but maybe it should be ugly, and that was on the work requirement for food stamps. Some of you may remember this, a bill dying in committee that simply, right, started out as a larger food stamps reform. And so the state of Kentucky had gone above federal standards for SNAP benefits and was awarding SNAP benefits to people who were making 200% of poverty. Federal guidelines was 130%, but they upped it to 200%. They got rid of an assets test. So federal guidelines, it depends on your situation, but basically you can't have more than $4,000 or $5,000 right around there in your bank account, or you can't qualify or have more than $4,000 or $5,000 in assets, or you can't qualify for food stamps because basically they're saying, look, you know, food's one of those basic needs. You should be taking care of that. And so they took away the assets test completely, meaning that you could have $1 million in the bank, a boat, four houses, but if you made below 200% of poverty, just because you made below it, and there's also, keep in mind, you can reduce down your income, you had exemptions or deductions such as rents and mortgages that could deduct down the amount you're making and adjust that net amount that they would consider, you could still get food stamps. And then it also had some different provisions as far as work requirements go. And a lot of it was taken out. And, you know, the bill that was initially passed in the House was covered all that. But then it goes over to the Senate, and all that gets taken out. And the only thing that was left was a work requirement for volunteer. So you could work 20 hours a week, volunteer 20 hours a week, combination of the two, or go to school 20 hours a week, a combination of any of those three. As long as you're doing a combination of one of those three for 20 hours, you could qualify for food stamps. And that requirement only existed for people without dependents. So if you didn't have kids, you had to either work, volunteer, or go to school. A simple requirement, 20 hours a week, work, volunteer, go to school. If you have no kids, because what else are you doing with your life anyways? And even that simple requirement couldn't get passed our Republican legislature, couldn't get passed. And it was killed by individuals that were either confused about what was in the bill Or it was killed by people who just didn't want the bill to pass. Because if I covered this at the time, the grocers lobbyists, you didn't know those existed, but the grocers lobbyists didn't want it to pass because they wanted to ensure that, of course, they make quite a bit of money off these food stamps benefits. And it's not that people wouldn't eat, but they wouldn't be buying those high profit items as much anymore because they'd only be able to buy their necessities. And so the grocers couldn't have that. And so they lobbied and got the bill killed. And that was pretty bad. Now, moving over to ugly, we're going to go over con law certificate of need, specifically House Bill 204. There was a hearing on it, and it was really pretty ugly. We had a task force in the interim on this, and that kind of plays into the issue. So we'll be digging into that after this short break. As always, if you want to reach out to the show, feel free to email info@theandrewshow.com. Once again, that's info@theandrewshow.com. And I mentioned it several times. I've talked a lot about several pieces of legislation. And as I'm going to, it bears repeating. If you want to know more about these things, I don't want to waste a bunch of people's time talking and going in depth about things I've talked about before on the show in depth. So head on over to theandrewshow.com. You can find all the places to listen to old episodes if you want to. And as always, if you want to listen to the show early, you can listen on WZXI, which is 95.5, 94.1, and 1280 AM in the Central Kentucky area at the 9s, 9 AM and 9 PM. You can listen to the show there if you want to be able to listen to it, because it doesn't come out till 1 on all the podcasting platforms, but at 9 AM you can hear it on the radio. So, but we'll be back with the conclusion on the ugly here in a few short minutes. So for our ugly portion of today's show, Good, the Bad, the Ugly, Part 2, talking about the things that happened during our session. One of the ugliest things that occurred, and I didn't even talk about this on the show at the time because there was a lot going on, but I knew I'd want to talk about it afterwards, deals with our Certificate of Need laws, con laws. So for those of you who are unaware, con laws, Certificate of Need laws, regulate our healthcare industry here in Kentucky. And basically, if you want to open a new healthcare location, you want to add beds, make a major purchase of equipment, you want to operate, you're a business, you want to open up here in Kentucky, you have to ask for permission from the state in order to do so. Just to operate, just to expend your own capital, you have to ask for permission. And a part of that process of asking for permission, what the state does is they turn to your would-be competitors and ask, is there a need for this service in the area? And if your competitors say, no, there is not a need for this, they have something called the competitor's veto, which the state will deny your ability to operate because your would-be competitors say they can handle the need in the area. Hence the name Certificate of Need. So it's not a free market. Think about it this way, right? Nobody needs a smartphone. Nobody needed a cell phone. We existed for thousands of years without cell phones. Nobody needed it. Nobody needed electricity. We had candles. That was good enough, right? Nobody needed the telegraph. We had letters. We existed for thousands of years without the telegraph, right? So imagine you had to ask permission from the state and they'd made a determination on if it was needed or not. A lot of our modern inventions would have never happened. In the same way in healthcare, it's not about need, because you don't know what you need until you get it. It's also about competition. It's about lowering prices. We have horrible healthcare outcomes here in Kentucky and absolutely awful costs here in Kentucky. And a large part of it deals with the fact we have one of the most pervasive Certificate of Need laws. And so with that in mind, Representative Proctor, Marion Proctor, has been a major push on con laws. The reason why is because she's from Northern Kentucky. Northern Kentucky is a big area. Hundreds of thousands of Kentuckians live in the area. But despite all that, they have one hospital system, St. East, serving that entire area. So if you're a nurse, if you're a patient, whatever, you can only work for one company. You can only go to one place for your healthcare needs. You don't have a choice. No wonder why their healthcare costs so much. No wonder why their healthcare outcomes suck so much. You don't have to wonder. It's obvious. And so with this in mind, Marion Proctor filed House Bill 204, which simply got rid of the competitor's veto and said that competitors, you still had to fill out your certificate of need, but no longer could competitors just say, no, we're vetoing this secretly There's no need for this. Get rid of it. Pretty simple and straightforward. And those of you who listen to the show may remember we did a push to make sure House Bill 204 got a hearing. And it did end up getting a hearing. That was very ugly. Now, in the interim, between 2023 and 2024, because Marion Proctor was pushing on this so much, the legislature relented a little bit and created a Certificate of Need Task Force, which held hearings once a month that were mainly shams. I'm just going to call them shams, where a bunch of free market analysts come forward. They talked about all the studies pointing that Certificate of Need doesn't lower healthcare costs, doesn't create better healthcare outcomes, hurts them, and hurts people's access. And then you had nothing but a bunch of hospitals come in and say, if you get rid of our monopolies, we'll lose money and we may have to close and we may, you know, maybe we don't operate here anymore. I don't know. Maybe you lose healthcare. I don't know. And so, of course, because the people who are currently operating are the ones with the money too as well, those hearings didn't really result in much. In fact, the task force's recommendation, so they had hearings once a month, hours on end. They probably spent 10, 12 hours in hearings and spent tons of preliminary time and probably tens of thousands of tax dollars. And their recommendation was, we need more study. We need more study. That was it. It was literally like a sentence long. We need more study. In fact, the KMA, the Kentucky Medical Association, and KHA, Kentucky Hospital Association, was so excited about the outcome from that they heralded it as a victory. Well, House Bill 204, Marion Proctor filed anyways because she saw where this was going and said, look, we need to do something about this. We can't wait. And so they did have a hearing on it, but it was a sham hearing. And part of it was because we put so much pressure on them. But another part of it was because they needed to shake down the hospital monopoly and remind them why they need the Republican establishment. Because the Republican establishment wants to knock out people like Marion Proctor, wants to knock out people in Northern Kentucky, wants to knock out people and protect people like Killian Timoney, like Michael Meredith, like Senator Meredith, like a lot of these people that are facing challengers that do their bidding. And the GOP said, they're not GOP, but leadership said, hey, here's a shakedown. You need us. Let's demonstrate to you why you need us. So they had this hearing. So remember, there's a Certificate of Need Task Force in the interim. And this is between 23 and 24. 204 is forward, though. That's what they're talking about. Getting rid of the competitor's veto. That's the bill before them. And they voted on it in committee this year. And this was what the committee members said. All of them voted no. Or a lot of them voted no that I'm playing for you. But here's a super cut of what some of the representatives said that were voting on this as they were voting no. And this failed in committee on House Bill 204 on the competitor's veto after the committee happened over this past year. Let's take a listen.
It's premature to pass this legislation until further study recommended by the task force is being completed.
Do I think Certificate of Need needs to be repealed? Absolutely. I think there's some major problems with it, and I'll be the first one to stand there and help you with it, and I'll even volunteer for the task force. But in this situation, I just don't think that this is the time. We need to see what the task force comes up with. And
I think it's a little premature. You know, the task force came back with a recommendation to study it some more.
Hope that we will continue working through the task force to find solutions and changes we can make to the Certificate of Need program so that we can improve those health outcomes. Thank you.
Certificate of Need needs to be examined, but I don't think we're ready yet.
So I'm a no today, but I look forward to seeing what happens in the future around this issue.
For them, I hope that we will continue these conversations. I hope the task force continues, and I'm willing to engage and have those conversations to look at where we can make changes. But I'm a no today.
Explain my vote. Oftentimes when people apply for jobs, I tell them there's three answers. Yes, no, and not yet. This is a not yet.
Recognize the need for CON reform. It's really needed. I was really happy to be part of the EMT task force a couple years ago where we came up with the recommendations that led to House Bill 777, and I was very glad to vote yes for that. And I think that's a better process where we can really have deep study, come back with the recommendations.
We have reservations about piecemealing this in legislation that hasn't really been fully vetted by the task force yet.
The bill failed, and And what did every single one of them say? Every single one of them. They all said, we need more study. We need to hear back from this task force. Remember the task force that came back with the recommendation of, we need more study. Now, obviously, this is a patsy for them. They're playing it off on the task force and that they need to hear from a task force. They really just want to vote no because that's what the hospitals want. And we know this for a fact. How do we know this for a fact? Because there was a resolution to continue the task force, to reauthorize it and continue, that was put forward in the Senate this year, because the original creation of the task force in 2023 only authorized it for a year. And so there was a new joint resolution, concurrent resolution, to continue that task force as recommended by the task force. As everybody that just voted no said, they need to hear from this magical task force to give them the answer of how to vote on something. They can't just naturally understand the free market has to work. They need to hear it from somebody, an expert. So did they vote to continue the task force? Did any of those people sign on to continue those task force? No. The authorization, the concurrent resolution to continue the task force was assigned to a committee and never saw the light of day, was never reauthorized, never got a hearing. So why did they have the hearing? Kim Mosier has a competitor. That was the chair of that hearing. A lot of those other people have competitors. Marion Proctor, the sponsor of the bill, has a primary challenger. Kim Mosier was getting heat to call this hearing. She is a primary challenger. So the establishment, in order to help bump off people like Marion Proctor, protect Kim Mosier, needed to remind the healthcare facilities, the hospital mafias, why they need her and need Proctor gone. And it worked. The KMA kicking in $50,000 to Don Parkinson's Rhino Pack, Conservative Commonwealth Coalition. It worked on top of all the other money it's going to put out. So what was that ugly, ugly hearing? It was a shakedown on your dime. It was all just an act. It was a play in order for them to bring in more money from those that they really serve. Not you, the voters, but the hospitals. Well, y'all, that's what we have time for today on the Andrew Kubrider Show. I thank you all so much for joining me. We'll be back here tomorrow. Have a great rest of your day.